Good afternoon from Washington, D.C. I'm Michael Oslin of the Hoover Institution, and I'm delighted to welcome you to the first of a three-part webinar series on Great Decisions, America in the World. This series comes out of a joint project that Hoover ran with the Foreign Policy Association of New York this election year to produce a special edition of their Great Decisions magazine. The essays that we commissioned for the magazine were about the greatest foreign policy challenges facing the incoming president. Over the course of this webinar, you will hear from 10 of my Hoover colleagues who wrote essays for the magazine on their areas of specialty. I acted as co-editor of the magazine along with the president of the Foreign Policy Association. We have upcoming episodes on this Wednesday, as well as December 10th, and we'll tell you more about those at the end of the program. Before we start, I'd like to give two quick housekeeping notes. Again, the first is to please mark your calendar and join us Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, and also December 10th at 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern time. Secondly, please feel free to ask questions using the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen, which I'll be moderating when we get to our discussion section. So let's get started. Today, we are going to be talking about critical countries. What are the most important countries that the next president will have to deal with? And I am delighted to welcome three of my Hoover colleagues to join me. Elizabeth Economy is a senior fellow at Hoover and also a senior fellow in China Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Russell Berman, who recently served in the State Department, is a senior fellow at Hoover and also the Walter A. Haas Professor in the Humanities at Stanford University. And H.R. McMaster is a senior fellow at Hoover, the Fuad and Michelle Ajami senior fellow at Hoover, and served as the National Security Advisor to President Donald Trump. Liz wrote her essay about China, Russell about Europe, and HR tackled the Middle East. So Liz, I'd like to start with you if we can. Famously, back in 2016, then President Barack Obama warned then President-elect Donald Trump that North Korea would be the biggest foreign policy challenge that he faced. What are the odds that President Trump will warn President-elect Biden that China will be the biggest foreign policy challenge that he faces? In fact, is there a China challenge for the next president?
Thanks, Misha. It's great to be here with you and with Russell and with HR to talk about these really important parts of the world. So we'll have to wait to see whether or not President Trump says anything to President-elect Biden during the transition about much of anything. So, but that aside, I think it's certainly possible that China would top the list of challenges that President Trump might set out for President Biden. Certainly would be at the top of my list. And I think the temptation in thinking about China is to think about it in discrete respects, so discrete challenges, you know, whether we're talking about Taiwan or trade or technology or even something like climate change, where there's both a challenge and an opportunity. But what I stress in my piece is that it's important to understand the China challenge as one that's fundamentally rooted in competing values, and that this competition transcends any one issue. You know, China's not looking at this point to have to adapt its norms and values to the international system. It's really looking to have the international system adapt its norms and values to those of China. And I actually think that the Trump administration, you know, particularly, frankly, people like HR, recognize this values competition and how it played out on multiple levels, such as the Belt and Road or in global governance institutions. And they worked very hard to rally other countries to coordinate a response. For example, the Quad with Japan and Australia and India, right, around notions of a free and open Indo-Pacific. That's very much about bolstering the current rules-based order. But frankly speaking, President Trump was really focused on trade and maybe secondarily on North Korea. He didn't seem to embrace this broader agenda. And of course, he pulled us out of international agreements and arrangements and often seemed to devalue our alliances and partnerships. So when I think of what President-elect Biden could focus on with regard to China, I think of him as leading this effort to bolster the rules-based order. And I have some thoughts about how he could do that. I can share them now or later in the discussion if you prefer.
Please.
Okay. So I would say there are really three elements to what could be a Biden approach to China. The first would be simply to get our own house in order so that we reflect our best selves, right? Getting hold of the pandemic so we get the economy back on track, thinking about what makes our country strong. President-elect Biden has already made an announcement about expanding immigration. I think there's work to be done around education and innovation. And then ensuring that our own democratic institutions remain robust, acknowledging the value of a free press, the rule of law, supporting our public servants, the people who count our votes. We need to bring back respect for these institutions because, you know, who we are abroad is a reflection of who we are at home. Second, President-elect Biden has talked about holding a Democracy 10 summit, right? So working with our closest allies and partners, other advanced economies in Europe and Asia. I think that's a good start, but I don't think it's enough. I think we have to reach out to countries in Latin America and Southeast Asia and Africa. China has a traditional base among these countries, and it's gained more support in many of them through the Belt and Road Initiative. So we saw just last month that when Germany brought a resolution to the United Nations on Xinjiang to criticize China on Xinjiang, it was able to bring, 39 countries with it. But then Cuba launched a counterattack, right, in support of China, and it had 45 countries. And so, we need to be in a position to reverse those numbers, right? We shouldn't be in a position where there are more countries supporting China's behavior in Xinjiang than there are condemning it. And then finally, I would say, the time is certainly nigh for getting the United States back into international arrangements and agreements, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Paris Climate Accord, the World Health Organization. I mean, if we want to ensure that the World Health Organization is more responsive, the next time a pandemic comes around, we have to be more, not less deeply engaged. If we're not in the game, we just pick up our marbles and go home. We certainly aren't going to be in a position to win.
So it sounds like you're, presenting, if you were presenting to the new president, very broad-based approach. Is there a particular area, and obviously you've mentioned getting back into international organizations is a clear difference, but is there any other area where you would see a Biden administration identifying a problem or a challenge from China that it would take a very different approach from the Trump administration, whether that's on Taiwan, whether it's on military issues, on the influence campaigns? Is there anything that, in fact, you see them perhaps distinguishing themselves from a Trump administration in?
I mean, I think on the issues that you just raised, for example, Taiwan influence or say technology, I think broadly speaking, a Biden administration will be in line with what Trump administration has done, what Congress has also advocated. I think there's a pretty strong bipartisan consensus on all of those issues. I think the biggest difference will be in that space of global, agreements, right, on climate change, right, will be actually be engaged back in the Paris Climate Accord. And that will offer, potentially some opportunities for cooperation, or if not even cooperation, at least aligning policies, at least perhaps pressuring China to do more on climate change. Again, if we're not in the Paris Climate Accord, we're not in a position to be pressuring China to, cut back on its export of, coal-fired power plants. So I think to me that that's the issue area that strikes me most immediately as having kind of a 180 degree difference with where the Trump administration has been.
Thank you. We'll come back in round two, and we'll ask more questions. But I'd like to turn to Russell now. Russell, although Americans in general have for much of their history focused on Europe, it's probably fair to say that since 9/11 and the rise of China, that American attention has shifted away from the continent. We still refer to partners and allies, whether it's NATO or the special relationship with the Brits, but we've been heavily focused on Asia, heavily focused on the Middle East. But there's a lot going on in Europe. By the end of this year, Great Britain may crash out of the European Union following on the referendum from 2016. It seems that President Macron in France is fighting a lonely battle against resurgent Islamist terrorism, domestic terrorism at home. We're looking at a generational power transition in Germany as Angela Merkel prepares to step down. Is it time to start paying attention to Europe again? And what does the next president need to know about Europe? And more importantly, what does he need to do about Europe?
Misha, thanks for inviting me here. I'm happy to speak with you this morning. The answer is yes, we should be paying more attention to Europe now. The transatlantic relations bilaterally to many of the countries in Europe and to the whole community of the European nations as the European Union. These are vital to the United States. We share a lot of history. We share a lot of values. We are both two very large economies with many shared or very similar institutions. So we should be cooperating with each other. However, the transatlantic relations are, of course, not in the best of shape, and this is not just a function of the Trump administration. After a generation of the critique of Eurocentrism in higher education, it's no surprise that Americans have turned away from Europe in some of their policy thinking. But there's something structural as well, and that is that the United States has made, under President Obama, a pivot to Asia, as he put it. And in many ways, President Trump continued that. Now, whether that pivot means toward a competitor in China or a partner in China, nonetheless, our identity as a Pacific power has overshadowed our identity as an Atlantic power. At the same time, and I think Americans sometimes miss this, there's a big temptation among Europeans to make their own pivot toward Eurasia. This includes China, of course, prominently as a significant trading partner, but also, and especially for Germany, a pivot toward Russia, the so-called Putin-Versteher, that element of the German economy that is very excited about opportunities for trade with Russia, although in fact German trade with the Visegrad countries, the four countries of Central Europe to its immediate east, is significantly larger than their business dealings with Russia. But we're turning toward our far west, China, and they're turning toward the east. So these two natural partners, the United States and or North America and Europe, are pulling in different directions. That's the big picture. Now, there's a set of more specific issues that the next president, presumably President-elect Biden, will want to be paying attention to. Let me just mention a couple of them. You've mentioned some as well, and we can come to back to them in discussion. But to the extent that foreign policy played a role in the election, it seemed to me that President-elect Biden was profiling himself as more hawkish on Russia than President Trump, and this is consistent with the narrative around the Russiagate criticism of the Trump administration, that Trump has not been tough enough on Russia. Now, I think President Trump, in fact, has been relatively tough on Russia. The expectation that the next administration might be tougher could complicate relations with many of our European friends, because both Germany and especially France are open to less antagonistic relations with Russia. How the next administration is going to skin that cat remains to be seen. This is going to come up most immediately around the sanctions on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which have strong bipartisan support. It's unclear how any president is going to be able to walk them back, and that is going to create difficulties in Berlin, especially. Secondly, sometimes the call to improve our relationships with Europe is understood to mean improve our relationships with Berlin, Paris, and Brussels, period. Right? Well, maybe London as well, but is that part of Europe is another question. But it's the what former Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld's called old Europe. We now have strong relations to the east of Germany, to the countries in Central Europe, the countries that really are on the front line with Russia. And the European Union is often very critical of what goes on in Warsaw, in Budapest in particular. And I read in the news today that the governments of Poland and Hungary are intending to block the COVID recovery action because of complicated EU politics. The American president won't be able to ignore these intra-European tensions, which is to say that it can't just be about solving problems with Berlin and Paris. We need closer and subtle attention to the many bilateral relations that go on within Europe. And the third point, which is perhaps not as obvious to American listeners, but I think is vital, to the extent that we believe that NATO is an important part of American security architecture, which I do, we have to pay better attention to Turkey. President Erdogan of Turkey is a difficult leader. Turkey is a difficult ally, but it's an important ally and an important piece of NATO. It's the second largest military in NATO after the United States. If Turkey continues to drift apart, that's not good for U.S.-Turkish relations. It's not good for the Middle East, about which General McMaster will speak, but it's also not good for the coherence of NATO. How to do that? Well, again, we're going to need some subtle diplomacy on this. You've mentioned a number of other questions that are urgent for any understanding of Europe today. What's going on in France? There's the response to Islamist terrorism, but there's a much larger discussion about secularism, about French national identity, and then the mysteries of London and the future of the Johnson government. All of that is up for grabs as well.
Let me just ask you quickly, you mentioned the importance of maintaining these bilateral relationships. Would you expect, and it may be implicit in what you were saying, but would you expect a Biden administration to pay as much attention on that bilateral front, whether it's with London or it's with Warsaw or Budapest or whomever it is, versus trying to go back to the bigger grouping, going back to the EU, putting more attention at a single point, and then hoping in that way to affect positive change in Europe? Just in terms of the politics of it, and you were recently working on all this, how do you sort of crystal ball what an administration might do?
I can't crystal ball what the Biden administration will do. What I believe is that for an effective American foreign policy, we need more attention. We did not have a Senate-confirmed assistant secretary during the recent years, and that's not been helpful. We need a strong ambassador to the European Union. We need a strong ambassador to NATO, but we also want credible ambassadors in all of these countries, and we have to pay attention to the, as I'll say it one more time, subtle differences that are ongoing within Europe. We can't, there used to be the quip attributed to Kissinger, you know, if I want to speak to Europe, who do I call up? Well, it can't just be a matter of a phone number in Brussels and think that you've solved the problem. Brexit happened because of excessive centralization inside the logic of the European Union. If the United States has an interest in having a productive relationship with Europe in any form, we have to be operating on multiple levels at the same time. There are enough smart people in our foreign service to be able to do this. We just need a political will to carry that out.
Thank you. Just a reminder for those who would like to ask questions, please use the Q&A button at the bottom. We'll be moving to that shortly, and I'll be moderating your questions. HR, You're speaking to us from Hoover Tower. You're holding the flag up today. The rest of us are scattered in New York and DC and San Francisco, but you're at ground zero. You've spent a considerable part of your career dealing with the Middle East, of course, including combat during the Gulf War, but throughout your career. Are we at a change point in the Middle East today? And if so, in which way? There are reports that a Biden administration might go back to the nuclear deal with Iran. At the same time, the Trump administration pursued what appeared to be a new policy of focusing on Israeli-Arab peace, so signing two peace agreements with Arab countries and Israel, and yet putting on the back burner Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. So what do we have to look forward to in the Middle East? What would you, having been the National Security Advisor, tell your successor about in terms of going forward?
Hey, well, thanks, Misha. Thanks for helping us put together this whole great a series of essays from which I've learned a tremendous amount, as I always do, from you and from Russell and Liz. And so I think that the headline should be, don't regard the Middle East as just a mess to be avoided. Because really, even what we're talking about today, I mean, the competition with China is playing out to a certain extent in the Middle East. What happens in the Middle East doesn't adhere to Las Vegas rules, right? It doesn't stay there. And we know that the catastrophe that we've seen, the humanitarian catastrophe in the Middle East in recent years, centered on the rise of ISIS and the serial episodes of mass homicide, that is the Syrian civil war and the refugee crisis, has affected countries in the region, certainly, but it has affected Europe in a profound way as well. And I think every time we want to pivot away from the Middle East, we wind up getting sucked back in, as President Obama himself said as well. So I would just say, please do not regard the Middle East as a mess to be avoided, because it is the inconsistency in U.S. policy toward the region, I think, that has created space for our adversaries and has perpetuated a good deal of the violence and this humanitarian catastrophe. And in particular, I think it will be important to have a sustained approach to Iran in recognition of what Iran is trying to do in the region. Iran is pursuing a degree of hegemonic influence in the region in a way that would pose a profound threat to Israel, and in a way that is already keeping the region enmeshed in this sectarian civil war. Iran's approach to extending its influence across the region and pushing the United States out as the first step in being able to realize its vision for placing a proxy army on the border of Israel is to keep the Arab world perpetually weak and enmeshed in conflict. It's trying to apply this Hezbollah model to the region, essentially. And you see what good that's done for Lebanon, is that state is essentially in free fall. But it's to have weak governments in power that are dependent on Iran for support, while Iran grows these militias that are outside of that government's control and can be turned against that government if it acts against Iranian interests. And you mentioned the JCPOA. I think it's very important, if there is going to be an effort to renegotiate an agreement designed to block Iran's path toward a nuclear weapon, the most destructive weapons on Earth, that it'd be a much stronger agreement than the last one, but it'd also be placed in context of this four-decade-long proxy war that Iran has been waging against the great Satan, us, the little Satan, Israel, the Arab monarchies, and then, of course, by extension, through its terrorist campaigns broadly, really against civilization with the attacks in the 90s as examples, in as far-flung as our hemisphere, and then, of course, continuing plots and assassinations and attacks in Europe as well. So I think it's important to recognize that the assumption on which the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, was based, which was that Iran, having been welcomed into the international community, having seen the benefit of sanctions relief, will begin to moderate its behavior and become a more responsible nation. That didn't happen. You know what happened instead is Iran took the big payoffs from the Iran nuclear deal, took the big payoffs associated with an alleviation of sanctions, and used that cash to accelerate its proxy war against us. So I think it's extremely important that the next administration put together a policy that is designed to force the Iranian leadership, and this is the real Iranian leadership, not the shop window of their foreign minister and their president, but the supreme leader, the Guardian Council, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, force them to make a choice. Hey, you can either be treated like a responsible nation or you can be a terrorist state, but you can't be a terrorist state and also be treated like a responsible nation. So I hope the policy aims to achieve that. And also the policy aims to place any kind of a deal in connection with the nuclear program in a broader context. And then just quickly, more broadly in the region, Misha, I think this should be a part of a broader approach to the region that aims to break this cycle of sectarian violence, because it's that cycle of sectarian violence that not only keeps countries in the region perpetually weak, enmeshed in conflict, and generates this kind of humanitarian catastrophe that we've seen, but it's also what keeps jihadist terrorist organizations on life support, because it's the ability of these jihadist terrorists to portray themselves as patrons and protectors to beleaguered Sunni communities that allow them to survive. And so I think it's also important for us to continue to work with countries in the region to isolate those groups from sources of ideological support. This is why I think we should, the Biden administration should continue the work begun by the Abraham Accords to have now three countries that normalize relations with Israel. I love the name of the Abraham Accords because it emphasizes, hey, we're all people of the book. And these jihadist terrorists, these are the enemies of all civilized people. It's worth pointing out, obviously, that the vast majority of their victims are fellow Muslims. And then I would just, in a continuation of this discussion of on jihadist terrorists, just point out the fact that I think these jihadist terrorist groups, Misha, are more dangerous today than they were on September 10th, 2001. We see a little bit of a harbinger of what might be to come in France in recent weeks. But those who perpetrated the largest terrorist and most devastating terrorist attack in history, these are the attacks of 9/11 against our country, were the Mujahideen alumni of the resistance to Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq alumni, the ISIS alumni, are orders of magnitude larger than that Mujahideen era alumni. And by the way, they are pursuing some of the most destructive weapons on earth. They're much more capable. This is what Audrey Cronin in her book, Power to the People, has described as sort of the democratization of destruction. They're better connected than ever. And so it's immensely important, Misha, for us to be active against what is already a multi-generational security problem. Not that we have to be in the lead, but that we have to support those who are bearing the brunt of the fight against these organizations, such as those Iraqi forces and Syrian Democratic Forces that we're partnered with in the region. There is a drive, as you know, to disengage from these competitions. This is what we're seeing in Afghanistan, which is a catastrophe, I believe. But I think I would make the case for a sustained engagement. I would point out respectfully to President-elect Biden, remember when you called President Obama in December 2011 from Baghdad and said, thank you for allowing me to end this GD war, right? Well, hey, guess what? The war didn't end. And what happened just a few years later, less than 3 years later, was that ISIS, Al-Qaeda 2.0, was in control of territory the size of Britain. And we had to re-engage there at a cost much higher than if we had sustained our a very small commitment in Iraq.
HR, thank you. You actually covered the follow-up question I wanted to ask about Afghanistan and the reports that the Department of Defense is planning on potentially a complete withdrawal before the handover in power on January 20th. I'm assuming, again, you think that's not a good idea.
Well, you know, what's astonishing about this, Misha, is that the Trump administration, I think, took all the flaws that underpinned the Obama administration approach to South Asia and just doubled down on them. And in this case, essentially conjured the enemy we would prefer to have in Afghanistan and in Pakistan rather than the enemy that really is there. This is the Taliban, of course. And of course, we've created this myth so to assist us in withdrawing that there's this bold line between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, a bold line that just doesn't exist. the Taliban exists with, you know, alongside and intertwined with Al-Qaeda and other jihadist terrorist organizations in this terrorist ecosystem across the Afghanistan and Pakistan border. And then we also essentially partnered with about 5% of the population against the 95% of the population in Afghanistan under this idea that the Taliban should be welcomed into some kind of a power sharing agreement. So what's happening today is in Doha, Qatar, the Afghan government representatives who want to hold on to the freedoms they've enjoyed since 2001 are looking across at these Taliban who are saying, hey, why are we even talking to you? We just defeated the world's greatest superpower. And so what does power sharing with these people look like? Is that mass executions in the soccer stadium every other Saturday? Is that every other girls' school bulldozed? So I think what we're about to see, we're already starting to see, is the humanitarian consequences of this, with this offensive in Helmand province and in Khost province, these murderous attacks that have occurred in the American University of Afghanistan, in a maternity hospital, Misha, in which these Taliban gunmen killed pregnant women and infants, right? This is who we're dealing with. And we're not dealing with the Taliban of our dreams. You know, we're dealing with the actual enemy, and we've done so in a way that's going to bring about, you know, a catastrophe.
HR, thank you. If you're just joining us, I'm Michael Oslin of the Hoover Institution, and this is the first installment of a three-part webinar on Great Decisions, America in the World. We have a ton of questions, not surprisingly, that are coming in sort of all across the board. I'd like to go back to Liz for a second, if I can. Liz, just yesterday, China and most of the nations of the Indo-Pacific signed a vast trade agreement called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. For those who work on Asia, it's RCEP for short. That includes Japan, by the way. It includes South Korea. So now you have the three largest economies of Asia linked in a free trade agreement, along with a bunch of others. Obviously, the United States isn't part of it. Have we just missed the boat on the free trade? Have we missed the free trade boat in Asia? Is it too late for us? What can the next administration do? Or does it need to look in other directions?
No, I mean, I think we haven't missed the boat. We missed a boat. We missed the big boat, certainly. We missed it when it sailed, and now we're swimming as fast as we can to catch it and get back on board. I think President-elect Biden has said that he's going to take another look at TPP, right? The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has become the Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was the, you know, sort of higher end trade agreement that was being negotiated during the Obama administration, which then the Trump administration decided that it wasn't going to join. And, you know, to be fair, both Democratic candidates also, I mean, both candidates, Hillary Clinton also said she wasn't sure she would be joining it either. So it looked potentially dead in the water in any case, although personally, I think that the Democrats would have found a way in. But I think at this point, it's going to be difficult. The agreement is already in force and it's operating. But I think it would be welcome. The US presence in the CPTPP will be welcomed. And I think there will be a certain amount of energy that will come out of the countries that are already members. And Japan, of course, is in the lead to engage with the US and to get us back involved. And so I think RCEP encompasses about 30% of global GDP. Mm-hmm. If we get back into the CPTPP, then that would be 40%. So it'll be even bigger. And it's a stronger, more robust agreement because it includes things like environmental things, IP and labor related issues. So it's a stronger agreement than RCEP. So my hope is that you know, that is what's going to happen, that I think pretty soon after the Biden administration comes into office, that it will take a hard look at, you know, what elements of the CPTPP we might not be able to you know, agree to, and how might we find our way back in. So I think there's the potential is there.
Yeah, and possibly indeed to increase it, right? Bring South Korea in, which adds even more to it. So I agree with that. Russell, we're getting a ton of questions on Turkey. A lot of them along the lines of how do we deal with Turkey in the way that you said, in terms of some of the more provocative actions that Erdogan is taking, and I guess a debate over whether they are actually more provocative than, let's say, 10 years ago. Is he getting more and more hardline or more and more destabilizing? But the question is, when they're an ally and a member of NATO, meaning, is it harder because you don't want to lose them out of NATO, you don't want to lose that alliance, that you really have fewer tools? Or is keeping them in the tent give you more tools? How do you deal with Turkey in the way that you are indicating?
This is really important. Turkey is a cornerstone of NATO de facto. If Turkey were somehow to decide to leave NATO, given the skepticism toward NATO in France and given the reluctance of the Germans to pay their bill, NATO could dissolve pretty quickly. Therefore, the United States should be paying a lot of attention to Turkey. Erdogan is one problem, his political aspirations, his personality. Through Turkey, however, there's on the one hand considerable anti-Americanism. It polls at the bottom of the scale of countries, of European countries. Turkey counts as Europe, of European countries in attitudes to the United States. On the other hand, in the deep state, so to speak, and in the military, there are still very strong ties to the United States. There's a cultural capital there that we can build on. We should understand that many of the provocative stances that Erdogan has taken have a lot of support even among Erdogan critics. It's a complicated, very complicated country. Nothing we should say or do should be taken as an apology or a justification for the human rights violations, for the crackdown on free press and on dissidents in Turkey. We should be protesting against that. But we should also not be severing relations because of that, as is sometimes called for. I wish we could find a way to mitigate the problem around its purchase of the Russian S-400 system. I think solutions are possible that could be face saving on both sides. There's an open wound around the relationship to the YPG, to the Kurds, with whom we've allied in the fight against ISIS. There's an argument being made on both sides of that, but throughout Turkey, throughout the Turkish population, this is seen as an issue. But Turkey, in Erdogan's efforts to expand across the Mediterranean, it's a player in Libya, and into Central Asia, a player in Nagorno-Karabakh, is overextending itself. And there are a lot of different fronts where I think the United States could be reaching out to begin to lower the temperature in the relationship between Washington and Ankara in order to rein Turkey back in. There are a lot of things that Turkey's doing wrong, a lot of things that we rightly object to, but we shouldn't kick them out because of that.
Thank you. HR, we've got a bunch of questions on the Middle East. Gene asks, can you describe, and this actually brings in something I'm going to circle back to Liz on later about how China fits in to these other areas, because it's been brought up each time. But Gene asks specifically, can you describe the strategic relationship of China and Iran and the reported 25-year pact and the challenges it poses to the USA? As well, there are reports of North Korea selling arms to Iran. How does the Biden administration address this? HR, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, it shouldn't come as a surprise that our adversaries are coordinating their actions. And I think that that's the case in the China-Iran relationship. There is a certain synergy there in terms of China's need for oil and the sanctions that are in place that restricts Iranian sales of oil. So I think that's a logical arrangement for them to take. There's been some debate, and I'll defer to Liz on this, about the nature of this proposed partnership that this is something that's probably been in the works for quite some time and may not be kind of a, what we would consider an alliance or go to that extent. North Korea, I believe, has been, over the years, cooperating with Iran on missile technology in particular, and as well as arms sales. And that shouldn't surprise us either. We should probably remember that North Korea's never met a weapon it didn't try to sell to somebody. And that includes their nuclear program, which they had sold to the Assad regime until the Israeli Defense Forces destroyed that facility near Dar Azor, Syria, in 2007. So this is an area that is obviously opaque because it is an illicit activity by the North Koreans, but it's one that we need to continue to gather intelligence on and apply economic and law enforcement measures against that problem set. But Liz, would you mind commenting on maybe China and the Middle East broadly, but in particular with Iran as well?
Sure. Right. I think that pact that was announced this past summer had been in the works for a while, but somehow it came out of nowhere. And so people were very surprised, very concerned about what it might entail. I mean, one thing to realize when China sets up these strategic partnerships, and there's a lot in there that is yet to come to fruition, right? And so you don't really know how it's going to play out. You don't really know how much investment is actually going to materialize. But I do think in the context of sort of a China, Russia, Iran, in the context of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that we are seeing a sort of a coalescence around a set of values, right? On things related to the internet, on anti-terrorism, on the way that they are undertaking military exercises together now. So I think, we shouldn't be sanguine about this partnership. I think there is a lot of it that's related, to China's need for oil and gas. But I do think that something broader is happening among illiberal states and in the context of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that we should be paying close attention to. So India is kind of the fly in the ointment in that particular grouping. I'm sure China wishes it had never let India into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, but we've seen that they've come together, for example, in the United Nations to propose things on cyber governance. So they're beginning to act as a kind of unified and coordinated grouping that I think has at least causes me some concern, and I'm beginning to pay more attention to it.
Hey, I would just offer one final comment, Misha. This might be an opportunity, right? I mean, we could say to the Iranian people, hey, you can be a pariah state with a state sponsor of China, and look how that turned out for North Korea. Is that the model you're trying to adopt? So I think we should be more direct sometimes at pointing out, what partnership with the free world looks like, and what partnership with these authoritarian regimes looks like.
It's a great point, HR, thank you. Liz, I wanted to just stick with you for a second. We have a question from Scott about Hong Kong, and I'd extend it to Taiwan. We have witnessed what appears to be largely the extinction of freedom in Hong Kong, especially with the expulsion of the Democratic lawmakers from the Legislative Council last week, and then the walkout by the rest of the Democratic parties, the non-Beijing aligned parties in the Legislative Council. What next? What do we do about it? And is it an indication of what Beijing would like to do vis-a-vis Taiwan? How worried should we be about Taiwan? And what do we do about Hong Kong?
Right. So easy ones. Yeah. I think we should be very worried about Taiwan. I think we need to look very carefully at what transpired in Hong Kong and the lessons that we should be taking away from it. Because I think, the temptation is for us to support, fully, wholeheartedly, and very naturally, democracy activists and the protests and, the sort of desires that they have to push for, universal suffrage at this very moment. I mean, which the moment now has passed, but at that very moment, But I wonder, as I look at Taiwan and current efforts to elevate Taiwan, I think we need to be doing it a little bit more quietly than we are. So we should continue to elevate Taiwan. We should bring it into partnerships in the free and open Indo-Pacific. I think it's fine. We have the Taiwan Travel Act and, promoting closer ties. Do we need Secretary of State Pompeo to say that, Taiwan is an independent country? I'm not sure that that actually serves Taiwan's purpose at this particular moment. And the reason I say that is, I'm not sure that we have the long-term, that we've sort of cast out exactly what Beijing might do in response to that, because we know that that independence is the red line for them. They've made it extremely clear. And so if we're gonna be out there promoting something that's moving Taiwan closer to that, or sounds like we're moving them closer to that, what is it that we're prepared to do, right? The Taiwan Relations Act doesn't compel us to come to the defense of Taiwan. It compels us to provide them with arms adequate for their self-defense, compels us to maintain our military capabilities so that we could defend Taiwan, but doesn't compel us to come to their defense. So are we prepared to do that if China were to launch a crippling cyber attack, follow up with some kind of military activity? So I'm a little bit worried that there's a disconnect between what we're doing on the political front and all of our military planning. Now, HR has been deeply engaged in this, so I would definitely defer to him, and he can assuage all my fears. And so we don't need to be worried about sort of pushing Taiwan out there before we're prepared to back up what that might then trigger. But similarly with Hong Kong, I think, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, things that indicate to Beijing that the United States is very directly, sort of working with actors like the Hong Kong people to somehow separate Hong Kong from Beijing, I'm not sure it served the purpose. And then what happens is the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act becomes a stick after the fact. But what it didn't do was protect the Hong Kong people. What it didn't do was preserve the freedoms that they had until 2047, and sometime along that path, maybe we'll get a different Chinese leadership that would have allowed for greater freedom. So I just, my feeling is we should be doing everything that we can to bolster, people in Hong Kong, to bolster Taiwan and its independence, but we shouldn't be trumpeting it, no pun intended. And we should be very cognizant of what our engagement might then trigger within the minds of Zhongnanhai.
Thank you. Russell, we have a question from Doug about repairing relations with NATO and key European allies without letting them off the hook to bear their share of the cost and effort of NATO. And we had a little bit of the answer that you gave about Turkey. And if Turkey left NATO, what about the other countries? Many of them have pledged to pay more, but they had made pledges to prior U.S. presidents. So Doug wants to know how we repair the relations, but don't let them off the hook.
Well, I assume that the audience is largely familiar with the Wales Pledge, where all NATO members are committed to reaching a 2% of their respective GDP in support in defense costs as their contribution to NATO. Many countries have or are on track to reach that. In particular, the countries who would not surprisingly to the east of Germany, because they are they're acutely aware of the threat that could come from Russia. The further you travel west in Europe, the less countries see Russia as a threat. Interestingly, I saw a map that describes culturally, are you willing to die for your country? And that is also a big east-west divide. The countries on the eastern flank, yes. The countries in the west, not so much. In Germany, I think it was 15%. Germany and France are the two big problems in this area. France, because President Macron continues to advocate what he calls strategic autonomy for Europe, to the extent that that means that the Europeans should commit more to their defense, one could only welcome that. To the extent that this means they're going to stop participating in NATO and participate in some non-existent alternative European force, I think this is a fata morgana. This is an excuse to dismantle defense. Part of this has to be understood, I believe, in President Macron's own particular agenda to profile himself as a world leader. He tried to do it recently in Lebanon, as HR well knows. He tried to do it in Nagorno-Karabakh. I think this is an expression of his own domestic weakness politically. Germany is the largest economy, so its 2%, of course, would be the largest piece. But it has long been reluctant to reach that. The Trump administration and former Ambassador Grinnell pushed hard on this, and they seem to be turning German public opinion somewhat on this. This is also, we can also thank Vladimir Putin for this, for his misbehavior. That is, after Crimea, after Donbass, after the various assassinations, Germans became more willing to admit that Russia could be a threat. Remember, there was an assassination in Berlin, not far from the Chancellery. The German leadership has not acted strongly on this, but the German public seems to be more willing to commit more to defense. Defense Minister AKK, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, has said that Germany should reach the 2%, but this is not yet a government position. What worries me, though, is the following, and I think you were alluding this to it before. We continue to have our election. 2021 is a Bundestag election. Presumably, Chancellor Merkel will step off the scene. There's some rumination that maybe she won't, because she's enormously popular, but I believe that she's going to go. There'll be a new coalition. We currently have a coalition of the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats. Social Democrats are presumably not going to participate in the next coalition. Even if they were, they have moved further to the left than they were when they entered the coalition. More likely is a Christian Democrat Green coalition. And this is going to be troublesome for transatlantic defense concerns. The Greens are very, very skeptical of nuclear weapons. We have NATO nuclear weapons on German soil. They're going to be very skeptical of the American military presence in Germany. You recall the worries that were elicited by President Trump's suggestion that we should move troops out of Germany. The Greens are going to be asking what role those American bases play in relaying electronic messaging of drone warfare in the Middle East, and does that live up to human rights concerns? It's not going to be comfortable. The only good news about the Greens in the next German coalition is that the Greens are the one party that takes human rights seriously. And therefore, they are concerned about Russia and they are concerned about China. What all of this means is that NATO is on shaky ground. The Germans won't pay their bills. The French want to have an alternative force. Turkey is Turkey. And pretty much after that, it's bits and pieces. There was considerable anxiety when early in the Trump administration, the president suggested that he would make coming to the defense of European nations contingent on their willingness to pay their bills. That actually had an impact. Some European countries have paid more. My own concern is somewhat different. If there's an Article 5 vulnerability, Article 5 is the part of the NATO agreement that mandates that members would come to the defense of states under external threat. I'm not convinced, frankly, that a German government, especially with Greens in the coalition, would eagerly fulfill its Article 5 obligations if there were, say, a Ukraine situation in the Baltics or in the West Balkans, if it were a matter of Russian tanks rolling in, as people imagined during the Cold War, yes. But it's much more likely you'll have a hybrid situation, maybe building off Russian minorities sympathetic to Moscow, or clandestine actors. And if there's wiggle room to get out of meeting Article 5 commitment, I would worry that some Europeans, especially the Germans, would be eager to find that wiggle room.
Thank you. I think we've got time probably for about two more questions. We have still a lot of questions, excellent questions, but really excellent answers. Our Stanford colleague, Catherine Stoner at FSI, asks about Russia. Now, I'll just give a preview that we are having Ambassador Mike McFaul, our Hoover colleague, talk at the third panel that we'll be holding on December 10th. We'll be talking about Russia. So for those of you interested in Russia, please do tune in then. But Catherine asks, in relation to what we've been talking about today, so I'd like to bring it up probably for Russell and HR, and then I've got another question for Liz. But Catherine writes, Russia is a frenemy of Turkey, as well as having changed the facts on the ground in Syria and increasingly in the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa. So how does Russia fit in the new foreign policy agenda, particularly in the two areas that we've been talking about? So Europe, the European edges, and Middle East. So Russell and HR, if you guys want to try to tackle that.
Those are a lot of specific points, and Russia and Turkey are allied on some points. They're opposed to each other on others, and American diplomacy should maximize the opposition between Russia and Turkey in the most Machiavellian way possible. I'm not sure that we've been doing that as effectively as we can. Russia is, Vladimir Putin has been able to insert Russia into world politics in a way that the Russian economy doesn't merit. My question is whether President Biden will indeed choose to profile himself as a hawk on Russia, as he seemed to suggest during the campaign.
Yeah, I'll just say that a sustained approach to the Middle East helps us counter Russian influence. Oftentimes, what you see is hedging behavior in the region because of concerns about U.S. complete disengagement from the region. This is why Putin's been able to get away with what we might call Putin's Potemkin peace plan, in which he says to Israel and other Arab states, hey, in exchange for guaranteeing Russian interests in a post-Civil War Syria and keeping Assad in power, I'll work overtime to diminish Iranian influence in a post-Civil War Syria. Well, that's a lie, right? Because Assad is more dependent on the Iranians than it is for the Russians, for the reasons that Russell mentioned already. Which is it's really that they're much more dependent on Iran than they are on Russia. But I think that Catherine's work that she's doing, Catherine Stoner's work on elements of power, how to assess power, is going to be very relevant to putting together, policy that Russell has mentioned, right? How to impose costs on Russia for this activity and drive a wedge maybe between Russia and Turkey. You would hope that Turkey is having some buyer's remorse in connection with its relationship with Russia, because it's really Turkish proxies fighting Russian partners and proxies, not only in Idlib province in Syria, but now in Libya and just recently in Nagorno-Karabakh as well. As you transition to Liz, I agree with you on Taiwan completely. I think what the administration has done on making public the six assurances and the defense, the defense cooperation is important. And I really think your point on amplifying Taiwan's voice in international fora is a great approach. And I do agree that we could push it too far. I would say it's not the Mike Pompeo extreme of the independence. I would call it now the Richard Haass extreme on Taiwan.
That was the easy one. We can't finish without asking you about North Korea. the perpetual problem for U.S. presidents stretching back now, getting close to 30 years with Bill Clinton. What to do? President Trump tried a very different approach. HR was part of it. Go big in terms of dealing with the top leader, the supreme leader, and see if that changes the dynamic from negotiations that we've been doing for a quarter century. What options, if any, does the Biden administration have? We probably should have ended on a happy question, but we got to get North Korea in there. So,
yeah, I can't say that I have any path forward for the Biden administration on North Korea. I mean, when I look at where we're at, we've lost sort of the joint support with China that we had and with Russia. So, we're off still maintaining our position on tough sanctions. The Chinese, the Russians, I think the South Koreans are much more interested in engaging. I think the Chinese are already trading more than they were. I think to begin with, we're going to have to get back on track in terms of sitting down with the other relevant members of the, party of five and six and talking about what kind of strategy we might have moving forward. Because, independently, we're not able to change North Korea's policy. That's clear. And so I think the only hope we have is, somehow forming some kind of getting back on track with the six party talks, trying to, move forward that way. I don't see any other option at this point in time. But maybe HR has a different idea. I mean, he's worked on this issue, so I would welcome his thoughts about what we could do moving forward.
I don't think we've ever fully tested the thesis that Kim Jong-un can be convinced that he's safer without the weapons than he is with them through an effective campaign of maximum pressure. We do have unprecedented sanctions on the books, but they have not been enforced. They certainly haven't been enforced by the Chinese. There are other ways to enforce those sanctions with secondary sanctions, for example, under maybe even Article 2 authorities, interdiction of the smuggling, a more systematic and comprehensive crackdown against the broad range of North Korean illicit activities. And then I think I'm a little bit skeptical about the multilateral approach to North Korea just because of the failed pattern of previous efforts, right? We know what the North Koreans do, right? There's a provocation. We put together a proposal for negotiation. The North demands a huge payoff just for the privilege of talking to them. There's a long drawn out process during which we make concession after concession and lock in the status quo as a new normal. And then North Korea breaks the agreement with the next provocation. So I just think we ought to try not to repeat that pattern. And we still haven't tested fully the thesis of maximum pressure. I think we could do that more effectively.
Well, clearly this is going to be a debate that will be prominent for the Biden administration. We're out of time. Obviously, we could keep going for a long time on all of these. And actually, they've become pretty interlinked in terms of thinking how China is acting in the Middle East, as HR talked about, certainly with Europe. But then Europe also getting more involved in Asia with, strategies from Germany, from France. Britain will be coming out with an Indo-Pacific strategy as well. The regions are getting more linked together. And so the debates will become one that we can have, I think, without compartmentalizing quite as much. Well, thank you so much, Liz and Russell and HR, for kicking off this first of three webinars on Great Decisions, America in the World. I'd like to remind you that we have two more coming up. Please join me on Wednesday. Again, Wednesday will be 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern, for a session on strategic stability with Hoover colleagues Larry Diamond, Neil Ferguson, and Victor Davis Hanson. And then on December 10th, we have a session on SARS, trade, and T-cells. That will be at 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern. That will be with Mike McFaul, Lucy Shapiro, and John Taylor. So please mark those down on your calendar. We hope to see you. Thank you again to my colleagues for joining. I'm Michael Lawson of the Hoover Institution. We hope to see you soon. Thank you.